What's up, Disrupt Nation? My name is Anthony Delgado, and today we have a special guest, my friend Felix. Felix is a venture capitalist at Entrance Ventures. He's the managing general partner there, as well as heading product vision at IBM and the IBM Watson team. So very, very exciting. Me and Felix, we originally connected in Disrupt Puerto Rico at our last event last year, and he spoke on the investor panel, gave some really great insights to the people that were pitching their startups. And now we're connected on the podcast to talk about 2019, what projects he's working on moving forward. And he's just an awesome human being and working on a lot of emerging tech and advisor to a lot of disruptive startups, man. So Felix, thank you for being on the show, man.
Pleasure to be here, Anthony.
So tell us, before we dive into all the cool stuff that you're working on now, tell us, how did you first get introduced to tech?
Interesting. So I think getting introduced to tech was a matter of necessity. I was born, I grew up in Nigeria, where Nigeria is a huge hub for innovation, but it's not one of the most recognized places. So by, just a matter of being in Nigeria, you're naturally introduced to people who are, every day innovating, and you also want to be a part of that. For me, it was more about trying to solve problems around me and being a self-learner using YouTube when, YouTube was pretty early to learn. That's just how the introduction started. So
definitely. Yeah. It reminds me of Puerto Rico. We have that startup culture here as well. And there's something about the entrepreneurship when you're in an emerging market where you're almost more resourceful, right? Like there's not as much venture capitalists flying around. There's not as much money flowing and, people have families to provide for, right? So they're almost creating these digital products and doing this digital entrepreneurship out of a necessity. And because of that, they create like more sustainable companies. They create companies that are actually more profitable than maybe some of the Silicon Valley startups.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you on that. When there are more problems, people get very creative. And I think this is why you see some, very interesting companies pop out of Africa entirely, or just anywhere where, just emerging markets entirely. In the U.S., Silicon Valley, like you mentioned, where I'm, quite familiar with, you see companies that are, not to say the Ubers are not, great, they're doing a lot of impact in transportation, but you see more companies in emerging markets that are actually solving real world problems that address, healthcare, education, and that's because these are problems that people have actually experienced personally. So,
Definitely. Yeah, it also reminds me of a company out of Puerto Rico, BrainHigh. So they just got accepted into Y Combinator last year. They were one of the first companies to do so. And they were the only company in their cohort that was profitable from day one. And they're like, yeah, dude, like we're here to, it's a solution for medical facilities. And yeah, they were like, we need to be profitable. I mean, we have mouths to feed and we have families to provide for and, and we're super happy to be in Silicon Valley and get accepted into the startup, but like, no, we need to be profitable first.
Absolutely. That's the right mindset every company should, at least every startup should have. Raising venture capital, it's not the goal. Building a sustainable company should be the goal for most companies and solving real world problems. So
Definitely. So then walk us through, how you got involved with IBM and what you do there.
So I actually started off on a large scale, I said Fortune 500 career at IBM back in 2012, I believe, 2013, as a software engineer on a product that became Watson. It was an SPSS. So I did a lot of work at IBM and left IBM after a while and just returned to IBM earlier this year as an advisory offering manager, what is known in the world as product manager, so advisory product manager. And I work on a couple of things within Watson and cloud. As big as IBM is, it's a family of, it's a company of over almost 400,000 employees and products that are used globally by B2B companies or just enterprise companies entirely. So my work is pulling together most of experience I have in building products outside of the United States or locally within the United States and helping IBM implement the same. But most especially helping IBM actually understand how to communicate what they build to millennials entirely. How do you get a company as IBM to talk to the everyday person. How do you get IBM? How do you get Felix to understand IBM, or do you get Anthony to understand IBM? That's what I help with as well. So that's mainly the work I do. And every opportunity to increase diversity within IBM is something I'm actively involved in as well.
Definitely. How's your role differed from, when you were there back in 2013 to now you're returning, obviously at a more senior role, right? How's your role differed from then to now? Like, were you doing like DevOps and like coding back then? And then like, how has that paradigm shift in the last, half a decade?
Absolutely. So back when I joined IBM, I've had significant career progression within IBM while I was there previously. You're taking a vision of someone and you're implementing and building it out for them, and you translating that to customers and getting them to use it. Today, what I do is actually help drive vision of where the product goes, what are the customers, how do we identify them, how do we identify the pain points that they experience, and then provide solutions to those problems. And beyond what I do in terms of career, that's changed a lot is IBM as a whole. The IBM that I worked at, several years back, and IBM of today, it's a completely different company. IBM is actively involved in the customer experience. It's consistently listening to people that use your products. And I think that's something every company should do today, especially considering the company has been, in existence for hundreds of years, right? Company that was involved in landing the first man in the moon, still in existence today. How can they evolve, and how can they be here in the next 10 years? And that's where coming to play and helping IBM drive that vision.
Definitely. I love that. And then let's talk a little bit about Entrance Ventures. What's the mission of that organization, and what are some of the projects that you've been involved with there?
Absolutely. So Entrance Ventures actually came out of my experience raising venture for my company. So after I left IBM, I worked in two different startups. One as chief product officer, helping to build solar energy, provide solar energy to Nigeria. And the second was a travel company, travel experience company, where we were helping governments identify what people were interested in when they were visiting countries. And one of the hardest challenges as a person of color, most especially someone who is not even a United States citizen, was finding capital. So when you said I'm building this interesting product, then it's in a market outside of the United States. Silicon Valley closes its doors. So the second way we're able to raise capital, the company got to a point of what we'll consider success. And I wanted to make sure that the next person who was knocking at the door to raise funding, to work in something that really mattered beyond United States scope, beyond the four walls of Silicon Valley, that they could actually be able to get that support. And that's what we're doing. So we pride ourselves in doing two things. One of the criteria for the investment we do, one is that any company we invest in would have to have an operation in an African country. And the reason we do that is there in Africa has a population of about almost 2 billion people. How do you tap into this potential? If it's a company that's looking at low end, low price, and they can certainly capitalize on the population to test out the product, evolve over time, and certainly get to scale. So we're ensuring that there's visibility for African startups. That's the second thing, but most especially also bringing innovative companies from around the world into the continent. So those are the two key areas where we are. And we invest primarily in pre-seed and seed companies as well, companies at seed stage.
Very cool. And I think you touched on some really good points. Like, there are barriers in emerging markets to access to capital, to even the mindset, right? Even the startup mindset, I think, is a little bit different across the waters and overseas, et cetera. What do you think, leaders of startup communities and ecosystems, what can they do to like help foster a more innovative mindset and culture in the startup scenes in emerging markets? And how can they like help bridge that gap?
So I think today a problem that exists, and those of us in Silicon Valley, we create this problem a lot, is to give the perception that because companies like Uber and the rest of them are raising, billions of dollars, that's normal for everybody. We have to let people know that not all startups succeed, right? I know this is, people know this, but people really need to get this down to their mind. Well, a lot of companies you're going to build are not going to succeed, and not because they're bad. Sometimes it's timing, another is just access to capital. So in one sense, empathy plays a huge role in everything we do at Entrance Ventures. And this, you know, this is also for my life. It's to consider that once you go through a role, your job is to ensure that you leave the door open for this to come true. So as a founder, you build a company that succeeds to gets to a point. You want to ensure that you can also push back and invest in other companies, right? You can take a salary and do whatever you want when you start getting paid, or you can invest in another company, no matter how little it is. So that's something that's very important. Solving the problems around you, it's a job for everybody, not a job for a company or a VC to fund or for, you know, the wealthy to address. It's something we can start doing with a little, you know, the $100 we have in account, or the $1 million we have. And for Entrance Ventures, we're one of the smallest funds you can think of. We're a $2 million fund. So we don't have the pockets of the soft banks and the rest of them. But we want to make sure that we can actually address support key companies or key founders that are solving real world problems. And I think that's one way we actually push innovation, because without capital, frankly, most companies are going to fail. So we want to ensure that they actually have access to capital to do so. The other aspect of it is just celebrating other people who are doing something really well. It's beyond funds. If a company says, hey, I'm having a mini launch, if I have the opportunity to be there, I will be there, right? It's beyond the money I can provide to them. It's a moral support as well. And I think that goes a long way in encouraging a lot of people to get involved in problem solving, and less so trying to build companies. I think the first thing to consider is problem solving beyond building companies.
No, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, you know, at least in Puerto Rico, we have a hustle culture with the youth, right? So like the millennials and, you know, people from the younger generation who are building these things, I feel like they get it. But then there's the old money on the island here, and they want to, like, you know, give you $10,000 for 50% of your company or something crazy, right? Like, whatever, however much they want to give you, they want to take half your company, you know. And, you know, in the, you know, if you had a pizza shop or a, you know, a food truck, that might make sense. But I don't think they understand the economics of, like, a global digital startup, right, that can scale, right? So how do you think we can bridge the gap and the divide between, you know, older startups, older companies and more traditional businesses, brick and mortar, and like startups?
I don't know if I can answer that question the best, because I haven't actually had experience traditionally with maybe invested in, you know, brick and mortar companies, since I'm more in a different, I focus a little bit differently. But from you talked about something I think is very important. Just a simple fact, the greed, that's a venture. And you hear this all the time. Someone, you give a very good example. Someone gives you $5,000, $10,000, and that's for 50% of your company. And you find that a lot of founders are in a very tight position, that they end up accepting that those funds, that they don't even have an opportunity to actually raise the next round, because, you know, they already got squeezed out pretty tight. So I think this still comes back to the point that people focus so much on trying to build company. That's when you start giving equity. If you realize that what you're working on, you're problem solving, there's no equity for you to necessarily give. So you want to start this a little bit differently. And this is what works for my company when we try to raise funds. The first thing we did was identify people around us who we actually cared for, who cared for us, like people who could support you regardless of if funding was not a factor. You want to list those people out and then reach out to the resources they have and say, hey, you know, could you give me $5,000 or $1,000 or whatever the case might be? $5,000 could be too much. It could be $100. And once you start fundraising from those people, imagine that those are the only funds you would ever get. And just build exactly based on that. Because I always say to these people, like, why would I want to, you know, take $100K from you when I can go take $1 million from somebody else? I'm like, you don't have to. But you can always realize that that might be the only money you're actually going to get as a company. The $10,000 you get from your family and friends might be the only funds you ever get. So you have to realize that just the best funds you're going to get, the best funds you would get are from those who trust in you or who believe in you, whatever the case might be, because they're not going to come knocking on your door the next morning. So you want to leverage them as much as possible, build a company, forget about that whole equity thing with VCs. Yes, we want to invest in great companies, But think, just imagine that those things never existed. A lot of companies have survived without having the traditional venture capital structure where VCs are taking equity or giving out, writing out convertible notes and the rest of them. So just try as much as possible to leverage your network first to raise as much money and build with that. Then go to a VC and have some stake in, be able to make some decision and say, I've been able to raise $5,000. So I believe I can raise another 5K or whatever the case might be. And then it goes into actually convincing the VC that we can trust in you as an individual beyond, your idea, right? A lot of people have great ideas. The most important thing is execution. So if you can actually show me you're resourceful enough to raise some money from the network you have, I'm more convinced that you able to build a company or get the company to scale. So I think that's one way to look at it. I don't know if I addressed the case of brick and mortar versus startups, but for startups in particular, I think this is something that a lot of people need to start focusing on.
Definitely. I mean, speaking about brick and mortar, you have like incumbents like, Amazon and Walmart, these giant corporations, and, whether it's a symptom of big business or big box business, whatever you want to call it, or it's a symptom of, the digital economy or both, right? How can mom and pop type of stores compete, with these on a global scale, right? Like 50% of e-commerce transactions go through Amazon.com. Right. So if you're a small business, whether you're a small e-commerce or whether you're, a mom and pop brick and mortar, right? How can businesses evolve and adapt in the shadows of all these giants?
Right. Okay. So I think one word to change is the word compete, right? So competing against Amazon, a company or let's say another company with deep pockets is a very tough one to do for a brick and mortar store that's been in existence for 20, 30 years with little to no access or they just have the name or they're just surviving. Competing is not what you want to do. You want to find ways to work with them, collaborate with them. And you find that, even Amazon, I've read stories of Amazon doing the very same thing with Walmart and, at the very early stages of their business, working with Walmart and selling out their inventory. You want to find ways to sell on these platforms. And the reason you do this is today people care a lot more about fulfillment than just necessarily the product because they have a lot of options. If I can buy one product from Amazon and get it in 1 hour, why would I want to walk down to your store, just waste my money and gas to go to your brick and mortar store? So you have to find ways to leverage these solutions at this point. That's the best advice I can give, especially if capital is not the best thing, the best friend you have. The second is you can absolutely want to leverage digital, right? A lot of the companies like Amazon are measuring a lot of things. They know how long it takes for someone to buy from the website, how long products stay in carts without being purchased. You don't know this is a brick and mortar store unless you actually, unless you have an omni-channel sales. You're running an omni-channel business. So it's very important that you either leverage them or just, simply expect that something is going to change in your business. Is it your customers will completely change their behaviors and start buying online? Or they just want to adapt with you. And some companies have survived that way as well. You might find a company that has a very strong brand and people are always going to go there. But how do you scale such businesses? That's where digital comes in. And I would certainly say a brick and mortar store today, if it's possible, you certainly want to collaborate with platforms like Amazon. And even if it was in delivery alone, you can go to companies like FedEx and find ways to better your fulfillment, because that's very important for company, for people, for customers today. They care more about fulfillment more than anything else. So brick and mortar stores have to pay attention to this entirely.
Definitely. There's another type of disruption that, I spoke about it last year. I wrote a piece in Forbes about like the three industries that are going to get disrupted by automation. And one of the big ones that's really going to hit the middle class is the trucking industry, right? So in the States, tractor trailer trucking, it's a really big industry. It's one of the really good middle class jobs that people can get and really provide a good income for their family. And, Tesla and Amazon and these companies are coming out with ways to automate tractor trailer driving. And they're thinking within the next 5 years, those jobs are going to start disappearing. you know, what advice do you think we can give to, you know, the coal miners and the tractor trailer truck drivers and, you know, or as a society, you know, what do you think the answer is to all these people going, going on the unemployment line, right? There's Andrew Yang, who's a political candidate for 2020. He suggested like universal basic income. Like, what do you think with all the automation and the AI that's coming and all these manual jobs that are going to be going extinct? What do you think the answer is, you know, both on a societal level and, you know, on a personal level?
So I think this applies across the board, right? With innovation, as long as it's change, there'll certainly be disruption, right? As you mentioned AI, for example, people have feared that AI will take away jobs. And we've seen it in cases like, you know, even in Walmart, where you have self-serve checkout systems and some people lost their jobs. This is going to continuously happen. But what you have to also identify is as this happens, there are more jobs being created. There are also jobs being created. So as an individual, the most important thing for you beyond the job you do is improving as a person every single day better than you were the previous day. And if you can consistently put education first, not the traditional education in the sense you have to go to school, no, you can simply learn about how, I think everybody at this point should learn some form of coding. You've heard people talk about this a lot. And that's because the systems are built by people. And, you know, as one job is, you know, it's out of the way, they need expertise, industry expertise, to actually make it successful. So if the Tesla is there, you know, working in self-driving trucks and the rest of all those factors, they still need deep industry expertise from people who have done it. And that's where these people come in. So I can't necessarily say, you know, universal income is going to solve the problem. It's never crossed my mind. I think adding additional layers of education to what you already know would always create an opportunity for places you have been. So you can, today it's AI. Several years ago, it was people using typewriters, computers came out, they evolved from that, and it's going to consistently happen day after day. You just have to find other opportunities to also learn from. And while this may not be the best answer for a lot of people, it's the reality of the world we live in. Education is one thing that will always set you apart. Not necessarily traditional education, to be clear.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, learning to code, right? Going to a coding boot camp, going to, you know, they have project manager boot camps and all sorts of ways to augment your education, right?
Correct. And certainly YouTube, right? When I talk to people, engineers at IBM, and they say, how did you learn how to, you know, code? How did you learn how to do this? I always say YouTube. And, you know, some people are surprised, and I find it interesting because YouTube is a resource that a lot of people don't leverage. It has, you know, you have free content. You can watch people run through demos of products. You can watch, or you can go pay for a bootcamp, right? Or you can just simply learn projects and actually work through them. I've used YouTube to learn 3D modeling from, you know, enhance my knowledge in AI products, practice a lot of projects. You can certainly do a lot of these things. I've used it for even just speech writing. You can use it for a ton of things. And again, you don't have to always spend money to gain knowledge. You can always get knowledge for free. In this case, YouTube is one platform, as long as you have access to internet, in this case. And I believe a lot of people in the United States would have access to that. So if that's the audience, you can start from there and certainly learn something new every single day. So that when the opportunity comes, you have something that you can actually add value to.
Yeah, definitely. No, YouTube is amazing. It's just hours, endless hours of content. I think, I don't know, there's some crazy stat that like, I don't know, every hour there's as much content on YouTube uploaded than like existed in all TV in the first like 40 years that they were making TV. Like some crazy statistic of, you know, the amount of content that's just being created for that platform, and it's all free.
Right. And while you mentioned that, I hate to sound like this is a paid ad, but this is where podcasts come in as well. So if you listen to the Disrupt podcast, you're hearing a lot of people with diverse backgrounds tell you about things they've done and how you can learn from the things they've done and implement it in your life. I think that's another value that people need to capture on. I listen to lots of podcasts, not necessarily because of people talking are the best people in the world, but because I can learn something from them. And I think that's another layer of learning. Just simply, you know, while you're driving to work, you can have a podcast running. You can certainly listen to the Disrupt podcast or whatever you find to be the perfect fit for your preference. And just learn something new. It's beyond just spending, dedicating time to learning. It can be a continuous process. Listen, while you listen to music, listen to podcasts as well. And you can learn a whole lot.
Definitely. You can learn more from people's mistakes sometimes than even their wins, right? You can
absolutely
learn more from their failures so that you don't make those same mistakes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. And what, but besides our podcast, I know we're your favorite podcast ever, but besides ours, what are some other ones that you like to check out?
So I listen randomly, just because I'm in an investor side. I listen a lot to investor-related podcasts. Jason is one person, a lot of people who are interested in, Jason Calacanis, for those who don't know, who's an angel, one of the top angels in Silicon Valley. I think he has about 3 unicorns. I listen a lot to his podcast. I follow them online. He has video sessions as well. Where he invites speakers to CEOs of companies to come on board and talk about how, you know, they build companies, challenges they faced. And it's one everybody should certainly look into, whether you're building a company, you're raising funds, or you're building a new fund. Jason is someone to look into. And that's Jason Calacanis. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I think there's definitely a podcast revolution. I made a video in December, and I was saying, you know, 2019 is going to be the year of the podcast. And, you know, lo and behold, in January, we saw Ron Burgundy podcast pop up, which is like, you know, backed by like the big corporations. Apple did a deal with Oprah. It's like all these like brand deals. The Rock, I think, launched a podcast. Like all these big brand deals are really getting into this medium. And I think a big part of it is the dual time, right? Like you can listen to a podcast while you're at the gym. You can listen to the podcast while you're on your way to work, you know, while you're working, right? Like you can literally just be consuming content and learning from people, you know, while you're multitasking, while you're cooking, while you're doing other things, right? And like you mentioned, I mean, it's a new form of education.
Absolutely. And I forgot to mention the name of Jason's, for those who might want to look into it. It's called This Week in Startups. So it's a very good learning environment if you really want to just hear from people who have failed, Anthony mentioned, the people who have succeeded as well. Certainly want to look into that just for the future. And then there's Recode Decode. I don't know if you've ever heard of those, but that's another very good podcast I listen to.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I think Recode is owned by Gimlet Media, which was acquired by Spotify this week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Spotify acquired them for some crazy $200 million or something. And they're just a producer of podcasts. They have Recode, they own Recode and a few other ones. And they acquired two companies, Spotify. So Spotify acquired Gimlet Media, which is a podcast producer, almost like a Netflix of podcasts. And then they acquired Anchor, which is like a technology that distributes the podcast for creators. So, you know, Spotify just this week bought both of them, and announced it together at the same week. So they're taking it seriously. I know Apple is taking it seriously. So, you know, if you're a content creator, you should definitely be starting a podcast. And that's actually why we just launched a podcast masterclass. So if anyone's interested in working with us one-on-one, we got a 3-month boot camp where you work with us one-on-one and we help you launch your podcast. So if anyone's interested in that, we'll definitely throw a link in the show notes. But yeah, we've launched about 5 podcasts so far with entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs and influencers and business owners. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun curating it. You know, it's a new medium. I mean, imagine anyone can start a radio show now. I mean, it's pretty crazy.
Absolutely.
So yeah, speaking of,
definitely a game changer, and it's something for people, like you mentioned, if you are intermediary, you certainly want to look into this. Just generally where you're creating content or consuming content, certainly podcasts is a way to go.
Definitely. I know we're running low on time, but one thing I wanted to touch on, you were speaking, you know, we started talking about podcasts and all this stuff because we were talking about education, right? And, you know, you're from Africa. This podcast is being recorded in Puerto Rico. We've been talking about emerging markets as well, right? And emerging markets where English, I'm not sure where in Africa you're from, if English was the first language or not. But in Latin America, it's not, right? And there's like that language barrier, right? Do you guys have that in where you're from in Africa or no?
So I'm from Nigeria, where English is the first language, but certainly there are multiple other languages within Nigeria as a whole. So for some people, certainly English is still a barrier, but to reach a large audience of Nigerians, English, you'll get to them using English.
We'll get to most of them? Okay, cool. Yeah, it's interesting. I have a friend of mine, he moved down to Puerto Rico because he just sold his company for like $700 million, some crazy exit, right? So we moved down here for the tax benefits, and he's from India, so he's telling me about how in India they changed the national language to English, I guess similar to Nigeria, and they did that because they wanted the people in India to be able to compete and be, you know, a part of the global economy, compete with the US, right? And they did that over 18 years ago, and now there's 18-year-old kids who are graduating from high school and don't speak Hindi. They don't speak it anymore. They only speak English. And, you know, there's like mixed cultural feelings about it, but at the same time, it's helped India rise as a global, you know, competitor in the economy, right?
Right. So I would say for Nigeria, I don't think we had, you know, Nigeria is British colonized, and by not our choosing, we ended up having to learn English. So, but what you'll find is that a lot of people who speak English still speak some of the language. I speak Igbo as much as I speak English. So you find that, you know, people still have that culture. Culture is a huge part of Nigeria. You could not separate the language from the culture of where someone is from in Nigeria. So that would be, I don't think we'd necessarily have that problem. You will only see that for people who do not live within Nigeria. Or who have never lived in Nigeria. That's where you find them with the language barrier of actually knowing their local dialects or languages.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think Puerto Rico is like kind of similar because we're Commonwealth of the United States. So I think it's like 35% of the population is completely fluent in English, and probably the other half speaks enough Spanglish, like English mixed with Spanish, to get along. But in the rest of Latin America, I feel like there's definitely a divide, and you know, it puts all of that YouTube content, just kind of circle it all the way back around, all of that YouTube content, all of those audiobooks, all of those podcasts, right? It puts all of that information out of grasp if you're not bilingual, right? If you're not multilingual.
I think that's a very good point to make. Is you find that a lot of this is the same thing with a lot of companies, especially in the e-commerce space. And you would find that if you travel to some other country, let's say you go to France, you would find, you know, a French version for, you know, an e-commerce solution, right? And that's how they're starting to adapt to those locations or to solve the language barrier challenges. And I think podcasts would have to get to some point where they can transcribe the voice to some of the language. That might be one way to get there. The other is to just simply tailor your audience to provide, you know, content for those, for people who do not understand English or who do not necessarily speak English. So that might be one way, but transcribing could be one way to solve it. And there could be multiple other ways we can explore, but certainly you can tailor your own content to a particular location if that's where, you have to make this accessible to people, because access is the most, is that one of the biggest barriers, especially being Nigerian, that I've seen when it comes to education. When you just simply have no access to information, you don't have access to that information, no matter how great it is to other people. So language barrier would certainly be one that disrupts, you know, that prevents people from actually learning or improving. Like we've talked about education for a long time now. And I think it will actually be good for you at some time to maybe consider putting up a podcast where it could be Spanish focused as well. I don't know if you're already doing that, but I think that'll be really good to get some people involved.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's definitely a barrier for sure. And it's something that we've been looking at, maybe not on the podcast side, although that would be cool, but on the educational side for sure.
Absolutely.
Translating that stuff over to Spanish, because it leaves a lot of people out. I mean, imagine it's almost like books that you can't open, right? Because if you open it, you can't read it. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely. Cool. I got like two more questions. One is if you had advice, if you had, 180 seconds to give some advice to the 18-year-old version of yourself, what advice would you give yourself?
I think the advice I would give myself is to you is not to it's a, try not to pay attention to the little details. Focus more on the bigger things, because you know personally we all go through the journey of trying to figure out what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen the next day. And while it's great to plan, it's also great to understand the bigger picture of where you want to be. You could ask me what my plans are going to be tomorrow, and I would never have an answer. But if you ask me what my plan will be in the next 1 year, I would have accurate answer of where I'll be. And somehow things fall in place. And I learned this in product as well. People who focus so much on the technology of how to deliver a solution end up getting disappointed when the technology fails. But the people who have that idea of what they actually want to deliver, the outcome, are the people who actually end up successful. Because you can change the technology, but the outcome will always be the same. So try to focus more on the bigger picture of where you want to be and not worry so much about the little details.
Definitely. I love that. And the last question that I have is, what does disrupt mean to you?
That's the word disrupt. When I hear it, I think, you know, one word comes to mind first, which is stop. The second is status quo. Changing status quo, how it is today, you have to change it. You're going to hear this every single day. This is how we've always done it. Disrupt the solution. Change the status quo. Do something different. That's what it means to me. And I live by this every single day.
I love it. Well, Felix, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. If people want to connect with you on social media, they want to connect with you online, learn more about what you're doing, where are the best places to do that?
I think Instagram will be the best channel. LinkedIn is another. LinkedIn and Instagram for Instagram is just my first name, last name is C. So it's Felix Ekwueme C. And then same for LinkedIn as well. So I use my Instagram to talk about a lot about investing, and also use it to invest. I actually have found a couple companies from Instagram that I've invested in. So
very cool. Well, Felix, thank you so much again for being on the show, brother. And yeah, I hope to have you back in Puerto Rico sometime soon.
Awesome. It's a pleasure. Always happy to be back in Puerto Rico anytime.
All right. Talk soon.